political headlines this hour. Moscow bans the British Prime Minister and 12 other political figures from entering Russia, in response to, quote, British government's hostile actions. Israel's latest raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque prompts a flurry of reactions from governments, people, and organizations around the globe. Also, Shanghai reports a record number of symptomatic COVID-19 cases, while other areas across China impose restrictions amid attempts to stamp out the Omicron variant. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Taiwan. This is BNews. Thanks for joining us. Russia has banned 13 current and former British officials, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson, from entering the country over the UK's, quote, unprecedented hostile actions. The Foreign Ministry says the decision is particularly in retaliation for the UK's sanctions against Russian officials over the war in Ukraine. It says that London has launched an information and political campaign to isolate Russia internationally and to strangle its economy. Moscow accuses the UK of deliberately aggravating the situation in Ukraine by sending deadly weapons and pushing its allies and other countries to impose large-scale sanctions against Russia. Moscow's entry blacklist also includes Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, the Defense Secretary Ben Wallace, and former Prime Minister Theresa May. In March, Moscow imposed a similar ban against U.S. President Joe Biden. It's day 52 of the Russia-Ukraine war, and here are the latest developments. Russia says it has hit more than 800 military targets overnight, including some 40 command posts. It also struck an armored vehicle plant in the capital of Kyiv and a military repair facility in the southern city of Mykolaiv. Russia says its air defenses have shut down a Ukrainian Su-25 jet in the Kharkiv region. Meanwhile, pro-Russian forces in the eastern Luhansk region say the Ukrainian military has repeatedly shelled settlements there over the past 24 hours. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on his allies to quickly supply the weapons that he wants. He said the sooner Ukraine gets the weapons, the sooner there will be peace. Russia has already warned of unpredictable consequences if the West sends more arms to Ukraine. International reactions are pouring in over Israel's violations, including its assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has called on the international community to force Israel to end the aggression. Palestinians say the aggression amounts to declaration of war, urging international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Turkey, Iraq, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia have strongly condemned the raid, saying that Tel Aviv must be held to account. Lebanon's parliament speaker has hailed Palestinians' resistance. Nabi Berri says the occupation of Palestine will soon come to an end. Lebanon's Hezbollah has also strongly denounced the storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the, quote, barbaric attack against worshippers. It says the invasion was a serious violation of the sanctity of the holy site. Jordanians also hit the streets of the capital, Amman, in solidarity with Palestinians. The protesters gathered near the Israeli embassy waving Palestinian flags. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has also denounced the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and hailed Palestinian steadfastness. Meanwhile, the UN chief has voiced grave concerns over the situation in Al-Quds, urging Israeli and Palestinian leaders to avoid further escalation. The European Union has called for an immediate end to violence in Al-Quds. Germany, France, Italy, and Spain have issued a joint statement expressing concern but falling short of condemning Israel's assault. Russia, however, has slammed Israeli actions, criticizing the regime for turning the Gaza Strip into, quote, a prison under open sky. Moscow has also blasted what it called the illegal occupation and the creeping annexation of the Palestinian territories. And Israel's main backer, the U.S., says it is deeply concerned about the latest escalation and has urged all sides to exercise restraint. Pro-Palestine activist Charlotte Cate says the Israeli attack on Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque is a horrific act against all Palestinian people as a whole.
It's absolutely a horrific attack on the Palestinian people and on Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and on the Palestinian people as a whole. This is a site that is sacred, that is respected by all Palestinians. And so it's a very deliberate attempt by a colonial state, by a colonial power, to attack people who are engaged in worship, who are engaged in prayer, and who are saying that Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be destroyed, will not be undermined. You know, there has been an attempt by the same regime to stir up the most racist, extreme Zionist settlers to engage in, you know, the slaughtering of sacrifices at Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to essentially create a desecration, in order to create a false view of what's happening in Palestine, as if this is a struggle between religions rather than what it is, a fight for people mm-hmm. against colonialism, against a Zionist regime, a project that is supported by U.S. imperialism, by the European Union, by Canada, by the United Kingdom, in order to undermine and seize and control Palestinian land and resources. And this includes the attack on holy sites that are very sacred to Muslims, to Christians, and to the Palestinian people as a whole.
China's commercial hub, Shanghai, has reported a record number of symptomatic coronavirus. The city registered 3,500 symptomatic and nearly 20,000 asymptomatic cases on Friday. Shanghai's COVID case tally makes up the vast majority of cases nationwide, even as most of its 25 million residents remain under a lockdown. Other areas across China are also imposing restrictions. Authorities are urging residents to avoid unnecessary trips outside and are encouraging employees to work from home. Vehicles have been banned from traveling unless with special permission. Infections have been rising despite lockdown measures. China has implemented a strict zero COVID policy aimed at eradicating transmissions. The policy has severely impacted the supply chain and goods distribution. Tehran has decried Britain's announced plan to force asylum seekers residing in the country into migrating to Rwanda. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the move means the UK is shirking its international responsibilities and obligations and passing the buck to a third country. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the move is also in violation of asylum seekers' rights stipulated in relevant conventions and human rights treaties. Britain announced its plan on Thursday to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda for processing and settlement there. The British government says it aims to tackle people smuggling and to fix its broken asylum system, but opposition politicians and human rights defenders have branded it as inhumane. The UN also said the plan raises human rights concerns. Lee Jasper is a race and equalities activist who joins us from London. Ian Williams is a journalist, analyst, and writer who joins us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Lee Jasper, let me first start with you. The explanation given by the UK government is that we're going to send them there because we want to process them there and have them live there. Do you buy that, just the justification that the UK is explaining?
No, because it flies in the face of the offer of President Macron to have offshore processing facilities based in Calais in France. And so this makes no sense. It's a huge attempt at political diversion. Prime Minister is in a very deep hole in relation to him breaking the law along with other senior members of the cabinet. And in order to divert attention away from those recently released news that the Prime Minister is facing a number of fines as a consequence of breaking lockdown rules, we've had this bizarre and left-field announcement. It's a means of trying to exploit racist sentiment that their government thinks is abroad, but which I think actually has been somewhat overturned of late by great compassion and sympathy for Ukraine refugees. And he's completely tone deaf to the needs of the country, notwithstanding the horrific effect it will have on those seeking asylum themselves.
Ian Williams, some of the criticism leveled against the UK Prime Minister treating people like commodities and saying these are neocolonial aspirations, amongst others. How do you view it?
It's a typical piece of upper-class British callousness to try to persuade people to do different. The aim of this is to dissuade refugees from trying to come to Britain because they might end up in the middle of Africa. And I must point out, everyone seems to have forgotten, that Rwanda, with which Britain has such a cozy relationship now, has actually been indicted over and over for human rights failings, assassinates its opponents at home and abroad, actually sends assassination teams into other countries to kill political opponents of Paul Kagame, the current president. So it's not just any old country. And also it follows a pattern. The Australians did this with Nauru. Nauru, in case you forget, is a small coral atoll that mostly composed of bird droppings, seabird droppings, that was mined out for fertilizer. It's in the middle of the Pacific, and the Australians lent on the government of Nauru to accept refugees under the same conditions. People trying to get to Australia were put onto this desolate, waterless coral atoll and dropped down there. And the old British principle here is least eligibility. The idea is that you dissuade people from asking for government help by making the help so unpalatable that no one will take it. I'm sure it's in breach of international human rights conventions, it's in contravention of refugee conventions, and like your previous speaker said, it's almost certainly Boris Johnson's attempt to divert attention from his own political predicament. And we might add here that this follows in a whole load of Boris Johnson's grandiose schemes that never came through. If you look at the cost of this, the cost of shipping a refugee from Britain to Rwanda, processing them there, and then presumably bringing them back or finding somewhere else if they're passed, is tremendous, far, far more than sort of putting them up in a five-star hotel if they landed in Britain. So it's not about the cost. The idea is to make it punitive and unwelcoming. And it really shows what a nasty, callous bunch this government is in Britain.
All right, let's listen to some of the social media posts on this before we get back to our conversation here. Our first post: this survey omits to make it clear that sending to Rwanda for processing is in fact forced migration. Any successful asylum seeker has to live in Rwanda, not the UK. In summary, take vulnerable people and sell them. This is what the UK has become. Shameful. The next post: Rwanda deal will end up with more people trafficking. It's expensive and probably illegal. The UK has net negative migration, crops rotting in fields, not enough healthcare workers, etc. But don't allow asylum seekers to work yet. 3/4 of applications are successful. It's cruel. Next post: UK has small population and only 6 crore. It needs more people to keep its economic growth for long run. So migration should be welcomed always. All people should not be sent to Rwanda, except dangerous ones. British people deserve no moral relief from the evil Rwanda schemes created in their names, whilst they fail to acknowledge that migration to the UK is an inevitable consequence of the poverty and wars propagated by the governments that they elect and on which their own wealth depends. And our final post: there is no such thing as an illegal asylum claim. It is legal to seek asylum by any and every possible means. There are no real safe routes to claim asylum in the UK, and they do not have to claim it in the first country. This sickening plan is illegal and immoral. Well, looking at the social media post there, Lee Jasper, obviously nothing was positive about that. And I'm curious as to why the UK feels it okay for this to take place and occur. But yet, if they're Ukrainian refugees or migrants, that's fine. They could settle in the UK.
Well, there's always been an implicit understanding that British immigration policy is a cipher for race and ethnicity and religion. And white Christian refugees have always had a more sympathetic reception than your Muslim or African or Middle Eastern peoples. And that reflects the implicit, the structural racism and the cultural racism that is so prevalent in the United Kingdom today. But, you know, this is a massive distraction. because Boris Johnson knows very well that he will probably be challenged in the High Court, and that this legislation will be tied up for years. So it's really a sort of a high-profile announcement that stands very little chance of success. But what it's predicated on is the understanding that racism and racist immigration policies are assumed to play so well in the country. And it's trying to offer that red meat, if you like, for the hardcore Brexit supporters that Boris is getting tough on immigration. But he knows very well that it's illegal under international law, as already been stated, and the likelihood he's going to be tied up for years in court. But he doesn't really mind that, because his objective is to cause division in the community, in the country, at a time of the most profound cost of living crisis, runaway inflation, and a prime minister who breaks the law. And he, like a trapped rat, is trying to find any which way to distract attention from the political and economic crisis that he and his Tories have brought about.
Hey, Williams, final question to you. You talked about how this is so expensive that it'd probably be less expensive if they were put up in a five-star hotel. Aren't there employee or staff shortages that they can be used in whatever sector or whatever field? Because usually migrants, many of them end up in, well, one of the reasons they get the jobs is the jobs that many people don't want. So they can, you know, perhaps get placed there. Why isn't there a focus on that aspect of it?
Because we're dealing with prejudice and appeals to prejudice that Boris Johnson is trying to evoke. He is trying to scratch the thin skin of the Nigel Farage Little Englanders in the bar rooms and get them fulminating. And his attempt is all he needs. He doesn't have to succeed. He just has to be seen to be attempting it to get those votes. And more to the point, to get those votes off his back when they accuse him of backsliding. I mean, this is very cynical politics.
Indeed. Okay, thank you so much for that. Ian Williams, journalist, analyst and writer from New York. Lee Jasper, thank you. Race and equalities activist from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. God said to Prophet Moses, peace upon him, O Moses, he who loves me will not forget me, and he who is hopeful of my goodness will insist on appealing me. O Moses, I am never negligent of my servants, but I like my angels to hear the sound of my servants' whisper. Dear friends, God tells Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in Ayah 53 of Surah Zumar, to declare on behalf of God, say, O my servants who have committed excesses against their own souls, do not despair of Allah's mercy. Indeed, Allah will forgive all sins. Indeed, He is the all-forgiving, the all-merciful. Sometimes injustice that others have committed against us makes us angry and causes us to utter insults. Often we are not able to control our anger, and this will soon lead to physical fight. This may even result in violence and unintentional murder. Fasting is an opportunity to control conditions and harness our inner forces, not to cause regret. Fasting of the month of Ramadan is a good practice to increase patience and self-restraint, patience against hunger and thirst, while trying to be good-tempered and observing the rights of others will make the individual patient. Statistics indicate that this practice has been highly effective on social behavior in Muslim communities. With the start of the blessed month of Ramadan, crimes and felonies like aggressiveness, street fights, family violence, shop and house robbery, murder and abduction decrease. This truly proves that there is a direct relation between worship of God and reduction of crimes, frauds and felonies. Ramadan is the month of practicing patience, and patience is one of the pillars of faith. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that faith is like a body and patience is its head. Moreover, over 70 ayahs of the Noble Quran are dedicated to the issue of patience in the broad sense of the word. The Quran always recommends the faithful to be patient and promises unlimited reward for the patient. Ramadan causes the divine light to shine in the hearts and makes people more thoughtful and affectionate to one another. Such hearts will not be aggressive towards others. However, they are very tough and harsh against oppressors. These are the hearts which God describes in Surah Fat as hard against the faithless and merciful amongst themselves. Now, in the second part of the program, we are going to mention some of the things that nullify fasting. These include eating and drinking, ascribing untrue things to God, prophets, and imams, sexual intercourse, breathing thick dust or make that reaches the throat, dipping the head below water, deliberate vomiting, and using enema. If a person intentionally eats or drinks something, his fasting will be nullified. But if he does this unintentionally, his fasting is correct. If the person swallows the food pieces between the teeth, his fasting will be nullified unless he does it unintentionally. If, while eating sahari, the meal before dawn, the person notices that it is time for morning azan or call for prayer, he should bring out the morsel and avoid eating anymore. So, If he swallows the morsel deliberately, his fasting is nullified. If the gum bleeds, it won't nullify fasting provided that the person spits it out. Meanwhile, if he keeps the blood in the mouth so that it becomes thin in the saliva, he can swallow it. Well, in this part of the program, let's hear what Lady Fatima, peace upon her, said on fasting during the blessed month of Ramadan. The dear daughter of the Prophet of Islam and the greatest woman of history, in her famous sermon at the Prophet's mosque in Medina, pointed to the most important deed in Ramadan, namely fasting. She said that fasting stabilizes sincerity and purity of intention. Thus, she says that the core and logic behind fasting is strengthening sincerity. She continues that sincerity is the sign of monotheism and theology. In view of this, the month of the divine banquet is the period in which human being recognizes God better and gains more proximity of God through fasting and other worships. Lady Fatima Zahra, greetings of God upon her, says, "The fasting person who does not keep his tongue, ears, eyes, or organs, what use will have his fasting?" Then she continues that the fasting person has done nothing through fasting if he has not kept them aloof from what is forbidden for them. According to the Prophet's daughter, true fasting is shunning sins and forbidden acts. Basically, any worship has an appearance and an inward. The appearance is what everyone does according to the religious injunctions, but what shapes the inward and helps the individual to reach spiritual sublimity and perfection are the conditions that make an act of worship pure. This way, our worship will deserve divine reward and will help us attain spiritual degrees.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The ongoing crisis in Ukraine has revealed the ugly face of Europe. It showed blatant racism against African, Arab, and Indian immigrants, despite all the human rights slogans adopted by European countries. Now, here is one shocking clip of African students who were denied the right to escape crisis-ridden Ukraine. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on racial discrimination of Africans fleeing Ukraine. The world was shocked but not surprised by high levels of flagrant racism perpetrated against the people of color in Europe. In the second part of our program, still on the issue of racism by Western imperialist powers, we are talking about the horrific transatlantic slave trade and asking, has slavery ended or does it still continue to devastate the people of Africa? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Ukraine crisis exposes Europe's racism. The world has witnessed dehumanizing treatment against international students from Africa, South Asia, and the West Asia in Ukraine. Many Africans fleeing Ukraine and other wars and conflicts around the world have not received the same treatment as Ukrainian refugees. While white women and children were given priority on vehicles departing the country, African women were barred from trains leaving Kiev, even though there were empty seats.
A Nigerian student fleeing Ukraine gives an account of some of the incidents of racial discrimination they endured. Let's take a listen.
I started running from 25th of last month. Crossing the foreign border to Poland was devastating because of the discrimination. The first discrimination was at Kyiv train station. They were allowing, said, only women and children. I said, okay, that's fine. But I don't see you taking the other African women and the other Middle Eastern women that are pregnant. And they were actually in the cold, some with their kids.
Now, for more on the horrific scenes of racial discrimination against Africans in Ukraine and other parts of Europe, we contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Now, our first question to you, to what extent has the crisis in Ukraine exposed the evil of racism, which Europe has been trying for a long time to disguise?
I think it exposed the racial discrimination a lot for those of us who understand the geopolitical context and that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is the primary contradiction in this issue. Everything leading up to that is because of that, and the NATO being a military alliance of the Western European nations and their contradictory or double standard way of dealing with other countries in the world.
African students in Ukraine did not just face racial discrimination, but there were also disturbing reports of many being forced to join the country's military forces. Ukraine's president has been appealing to people of goodwill worldwide to support his country amid the blatant acts of racial discrimination against non-white immigrants, particularly blacks and Arabs in his country.
It's a proxy state. The government is. And proxy states expect returns for their service of being a proxy. So when he makes these appeals, he's also expecting the backing and the support of, which we've seen with United States and other Western nations also inducing their populations and inducing as much as they can around the world to respond to these appeals.
The Ukrainian crisis has revealed deep-rooted racism in Western media's coverage of the conflict. Now, Western media outlets are under fire for the evidently racist undertones in their coverage of the unfolding humanitarian crisis. Now, these mainstream Western media outlets have amplified empathy for Europeans while normalizing the suffering of war and disaster in other regions of the world, such as Africa, West Asia, and Afghanistan.
Now the unthinkable has happened to them. And this is not a developing third world nation. This is Europe.
These are not refugees from Syria. These are refugees from neighboring Ukraine. I mean, that, quite frankly, is part of it. These are...
What does this level of bias and outright racism say about mainstream Western media outlets?
Western media are basically cheerleaders for imperialism. They portray conflicts in various places based on a reflection of what it means and for the interest of imperialism. Most of the conflicts in the world, most of them by and large, are instigated and supported and carried out by imperialism, even if it's through proxies or whatever. But they're for the ability, the imperialism requires the destabilization of various places so that the people in large, in mass, can't exercise self-determination and what happens with the resources of their country, the mineral resources, what happens with labor rights, all those type of things. And so when the media is reporting on places like, for example, what's happening with Ukraine, they're usually not reporting on a war or an atrocity that involves the opposition or the competition, so to speak, with the enemies of imperialism. They're usually reporting on imperialist wars and imperialist instigated wars, no matter how imperialism wants to characterize them. And so they report them the way imperialism wants them characterized. Here, it's in the interest of imperialism to report the most, you know, a one-sided and diabolical, you know, intent in terms of this war, because this is their adversary.
African countries condemned the mistreatment of African nationals trying to flee Ukraine during a special session of the United Nations General Assembly early March. Speaking during the session, Matho Joini, South Africa's ambassador to the UN, said her country joins other African countries in condemning the discrimination of Africans in Europe.
South Africa endorses the statement issued by the African Union Commission, expressing concern that the treatment given to African nationals and people of African descent at the borders of Ukraine, some of whom are not allowed to cross and move to safety. We urge European countries to take steps to resolve this situation, as all people have a right to cross international borders during times of conflict.
Have African countries reacted strongly enough to the acts of racism being perpetrated against their citizens in Ukraine and neighboring European countries?
I tend to think we want to make a distinction with the question, that we want to make a distinction when we say African countries, between the leadership of the countries, and particularly we're talking about largely neocolonial states that are just having to be subservient to international finance capital, have all the trappings of independence, but they really are governed and manipulated by outside. And then there's the masses of the people on the ground who have a different reaction and who really, you know, are expressing whatever they can. So we have to make that distinction. On the ground, we have people who demonstrated about, you know, against these types of things and demonstrating in a lot of ways for different aspects against this war that's taking place.
African students formally appeared to be welcome into Ukraine and injected millions of dollars into the country's economy, but have now realized that they were truly not perceived as equal, but inferior by whites in this country. Now, Mr. Freeman, what lessons can Africans learn from this form of racism?
I think the lesson in it is that white supremacy is a global phenomenon, and it is also about power. And that we have to fight for power in this world, the power dispositions regarding the economic dispositions and political dispositions, how much we can control our own, we have self-determination. That's what we have to fight for, and we have to do it in a mass. And we have to realize that we're in a global struggle against white supremacy and international finance capital, against the rest of collective humanity.
The International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is observed annually on 21st of March. Despite such a day being marked globally, we are still witness to shocking incidents of racial discrimination.
Now, our last question to you, Mr. Freeman, is the so-called international community paying lip service to the struggle against racism?
I think it's very interesting in the sense that even as the question is posed, there's a sort of an underlining acknowledgement that when we say international community, we're really talking about the Western countries, Western leadership, you know, Western European countries, rather. And so the international community has to come to be redefined. It's going to be only paying lip service to these things, because the Western world's preeminence and its supremacy in the world is dependent on racial discrimination and those type of things. So it can only pay lip service to it. And so we have to come to redefine what international community means in a way so that it doesn't refer to the Western European elite, and that it becomes redefined through a people-centered process and struggle for self-determination and for socialism. And so we have to have that.
Now, that's an interesting perspective indeed. We need to redefine what really comprises of the international community. Thanks a lot, Mr. Freeman, for your incisive analysis. And we'll take a short break. When we come back, we shall be talking about the transatlantic slave trade. Stay with us.
Remembering Slavery.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
For over 400 years, nearly 20 million men, women, and children from Africa were the victims of the tragic transatlantic slave trade, one of the darkest chapters in human history. Now, this criminal trade was officially carried out by European colonial powers. In commemoration of the memory of the victims, the General Assembly of the United Nations on the 17th December 2007 declared the 25th of March as the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade, to be observed annually.
The resolution also called for the establishment of a program to mobilize educational institutions, civil society, and other organizations to inculcate in future generations the causes, consequences, and lessons of the transatlantic slave trade, and to communicate the dangers of racism and prejudice. This year, the President of the United Nations General Assembly, Abdullah Shahid, visited the Ark of Return, the United Nations permanent memorial to honor the victims of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade.
Now, during his visit to this memorial site, which also stands testimony as a reminder that racism has no place in the world, he recalled his visit to Senegal's Gori Island.
Years ago, I visited Gori Island in Senegal, which was the largest slave trading center on the African coast from the 15th to the 19th century. I saw the small spaces, imagining the crowded rooms where the enslaved persons were packed. I will never forget the feeling of sorrow and distress, thinking on those who went through the very small door overlooking the Atlantic Ocean.
Now, for more on the remembrance of the inhuman transatlantic slave trade perpetrated by Western colonial powers, we contacted PLO Lumumba, a renowned Pan-Africanist and academic. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, our first question, do you think the transatlantic slave trade is given the attention it deserves in Africa and the Americas?
I don't think so. I think whatever attention we give it is merely salutary. One would have expected that an event as devastating as it was is given attention which is continental. One would have expected that there is a day that is dedicated in all African countries to remember that unfortunate trade. But that does not happen. In fact, one can say that the commemoration is left to a few public-spirited individuals, and it barely gets mentioned in many African countries, which is tragic in itself.
The British royal couple visited Jamaica from March 22 to 24 this year in order to commemorate Queen Elizabeth's Platinum Jubilee. This was just before the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. The visit was met by protests from Jamaicans demanding an apology and reparations from Britain over its leading role in slave trade.
Because it is an insult to us for these young people to be here to try to persuade us to keep the status quo in place when our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Now, Mr. Lumumba, what's your take on this visit, especially considering that Britain's royal family was deeply involved in colonialism and the slave trade?
Remember that the British monarch, particularly the current monarch, was present when colonialism was alive and well. And it saddens me that she is given the accolades which she does not deserve by those whose parents and those whose ancestors were traumatized and victimized by slavery. It is a case of selective amnesia on both sides. The monarch pretends that there was no slavery. The monarch pretends that there was no colonization, and the people also behave as if there was no slavery and no colonization. I think we should speak unanimously and tell the monarch that until there is an unequivocal apology from the British government, they will never be given the accolade that they so much crave for.
While slave trade helped turn America and Western European countries into economic giants they are today, many like these Jamaicans here protesting a visit by members of Britain's royal family are demanding an apology and reparations.
Respect us, man. Apologize now.
Sending a shout out to the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and the entire royal family that reparation time come now.
Isn't it about time that European countries involved in the evil slave trade apologize and pay reparations to Africa, just like they are doing to alleged victims of Holocaust?
Without doubt, you'd have seen in my previous answer, I've talked about slavery as if it were colonization, because in my view, slavery is really, colonization is slavery turned inside out. And in direct answer to your question, I'm saying that we deserve reparations. We don't ask for it. We don't act as a team as Africans. We are still victims of divide and rule. Your typical African leader, still, if they were colonized by the British or by the French or the Portuguese or the Germans or the Italians, still behave as if they are beholden to those countries. And that is why we can't speak with one voice.
Despite the so-called abolition of slavery in the United States, African Americans continue to suffer institutional racism, and the brutal murder of George Floyd is just an example of what people of African descent endure every day in America. Clearly, racism still lingers in the United States.
George Floyd is simply emblematic of what happens on a daily basis, and I think that it is incumbent upon us to keep speaking about and against it, because if we don't, it will continue to gain roots in subterranean and subtle ways.
The only known existing autobiography of an African slave in America was written in Arabic by Omar ibn Said. This autobiography debunked myths that enslaved Africans had no culture or civilization. How does the story of Omar bin Said tell us about the distortion of the history of African Americans?
The history of Africa has always been distorted, and if you want to see the dramatization of this unfortunate situation, Alex Haley's Roots dramatizes the modus operandi of the slave master. First of all, they took away your language, they dehumanized you, they humiliated you, they erased your history, and they claimed that your life only started when you were enslaved. You did not know how to write, you did not think, you are simply one who had a human form, but you are not a human being, you are not a thinking being. And that continues to be perpetuated even today. And the time has come for Africans to begin to ask certain fundamental questions. Why is it that they destroyed the museums which were found in different parts of Africa? Why is it that they erased our history? And we too have an obligation to make it known to the world that we had a history.
Over the recent past, there have been reports of continued slavery in different parts of the world. Now, Mr. Lumumba, can you elaborate on this phenomenon?
You know, in my view, slavery has always metamorphosized when the Western world recognized that slavery was no longer sustainable. It went into the next stage, which was colonization. And when colonization was no longer tenable and sustainable, it has transformed into the neocolonial project. And that is not to say that classical slavery has ended. We know that slavery is going on in different parts of the world. In the Sahelian region, slavery is alive and well. In different parts of Europe, slavery is still alive and well. But latter-day slavery is of an economic kind. We are so beholden to the erstwhile colonizer, the erstwhile slave master, and we do not know, and even if we do not know, we are not conscious of its very pervasive character. Today, the African economies are simply marionettes controlled from European capitals, which can be switched off without a notice.
Okay, Mr. Lumumba, our final question to you. What needs to be done to eliminate or eradicate these forms of economic slavery you just talked about?
African countries should work as a team, and there have been efforts in that direction, beginning with the Lagos Plan of Action of 1980. I now see the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. That is an initiative which would address the economic slavery and colonization that we still labor under. It is also important that Africans remove tariff and non-tariff barriers and allow their citizens to move across the continent without these impediments.
Thank you very much, Mr. PLO Lumumba, for your insight. Now, as our guest said, the African countries need to emancipate themselves from economic slavery that continues to be perpetrated by Western imperialist powers. And that brings us to the end of Vietnam, the edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you. And goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.